And it's actually been shown, and I've had some great conversations about this, that when we're forced to work in a standard 9-to-5 office job, it's detrimental to the mental health of someone who needs a creative outlet.
Welcome to the Social Fabric Podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Emma Langford. Emma is a performer and singer-songwriter, and she released her first album in 2017. She's also a mental health advocate and does a lot of work for charities, including releasing her latest single, Mariana, and donating all the proceeds to Save Ireland. The songs in this podcast have been shortened for rights reason. The program is also broadcast every Monday 4:30 p.m. on Near FM 90.3. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way podcasts like this have a chance to survive. If you want to get in touch with the program, please email me at info@socialfabric.ie. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days, and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
Let me ask you a couple of questions, and we'll get to that bit because I have that question in mind as well. Plus, Emma Langford, thanks a million for joining me. I want to ask you, I'll tell you what I'm going to like to start. You're Limerick based,
yeah. Or
definitely grew up in Limerick, you're a Limerick woman. Mm. And that was interesting, actually. Every time I look up anything to do with you, it was always referred as a Limerick singer songwriter. Just the Limerick. What is Limerick for you? What does it mean to you?
It means different things from one day to the next and one year to the next. I suppose it's home, you know, and it is where I grew up. I've had different relationships with Limerick throughout my life. So I suppose when I was younger, when I was a teenager, I didn't like Limerick. I couldn't find somewhere I fit in Limerick, and I didn't enjoy school. And then as I found music in my 20s, Limerick started to open up for me, and I started to see this whole other side to the place. I got to know the musical community and the creative community. And I feel like, you know, in a computer game, when you fall down a pipe or you go through a wall or something and you find yourself in this like bonus level. That's what I felt like when music happened for me in Limerick. And I suppose I started to spend more time in unique little corners of the place and realized how vibrant the place really is and how much it has to offer. And how strong actually the creative community can be when we choose to use our voice and use our platform for good. So it's a place that's kind of revolutionary, I suppose, and revolutionary in a way as well. We all have a lot of fight in us, and we're always fighting the bad rep that Limerick has had for years and years. And I'm very loyal to the idea that Limerick is not the place it used to be. And it loves people that love it back. So that's it for me now.
Tell me a little bit about that, just because the whole idea of this project is to really figure out the passion, where people's passion come from. And you just mentioned you didn't really like school. School wasn't really your gig. Tell me a bit about that bit. What was it like? What did you not like about
it? I suppose I made the mistake in primary school of following my friends at the time into a certain school that had a certain reputation and a certain level of prestige. And, you know, it was a really proud moment in our house that I, you know, got in there and went there. It's a great school, but it's very academically focused. And I just didn't fit. It took me until, I suppose, my senior years in school to find a group of friends that I really fit with. But in the meantime, I'd actually wind up going out to the University of Limerick and meeting the drama students out there. And my older sister was out there studying languages. And she was the president of the Drama Society. So she got me in on a few kind of different plays and shows out there. And I sort of found my creative side through that in a way, or got a chance to express it, I suppose, in a way I didn't have previously. I developed vocal nodules when I was in school. which means I couldn't sing. So I was part of the choir, but I wasn't able to sing, and it kind of knocked the wind out of my sails. So I never went for any opportunities to be in the school show or anything like that. So in my senior years in school, when I started going out to UL to explore that side of myself, is when my personality started to come through and I was able to find my friend group in school. But it took a long time, and I really wasn't comfortable in my own skin. I wasn't comfortable in that place. There was a certain expectation of all of us to fit a certain mold, and I wasn't going to do that, which drove a lot of my teachers crazy. A lot of them were really understanding and very patient with me, but a lot of them could only do so much. So, yeah.
Well, thankfully, you didn't follow that path. At least we have your music now to enjoy. So tell me about your first piece of music. It's from Les Misérables, On My Own.
Yeah, it was. It's actually related to the vocal nodules episode. I went into studio. So my parents would play the music of the musicals at home when I was a kid all the time. We also had a lot of Elvis and Garth Brooks and ABBA. And yeah, a real mix of stuff, but musicals was a consistent thing. And myself and my older sister, Claire, would we had a cassette of Les Mis, and we would play it. And because the internet wasn't a thing back then, you couldn't just Google the lyrics or something. We'd have to play it and then hand write down the lyrics, like play it, pause it, play it slow, all that kind of stuff. So when we had the lyrics, we would then do like duets, and we'd like perform parts of the different shows. Not like, you know, I don't think we were the kids that sat our parents down and made them watch us, but we would just, for our own entertainment, duet these songs. And so then when I was about, it was just as my vocal nodules were getting quite bad, but I still loved singing, and my mom could see that in me. So she brought me into studio somewhere in Killaloo and Clare, I can't remember exactly where it was, but we recorded a version of On My Own, and I rasped my way through it. Like, my voice was just not there. I couldn't deliver a performance. And listening back to it, a friend of mine at the time kind of laughed evilly at how I sounded like a little old woman singing, because my voice was so raspy and just out of condition. And that was sort of a moment for me when we realized there might be something wrong, and I needed to see a doctor about it. So that song for me has a lot of, I suppose, negative connotations, but I now see it as, you know, I recently did a recording of it and shared it with my patrons and shared the story of how musical theatre brought me to music in a lot of ways, and how singing that song brought me to a diagnosis of nodules. And, you know, it's got a lot of negative backstory, but now I see it as quite an empowering sort of a song that I can now perform and do justice to, and I know now how to take care of my voice and all that. So yeah, it's an important song in a lot of ways for me.
On my own, pretending he's beside me, all alone I walk with him till morning. Without him, I feel his arms around me, and when I lose my way, I close my eyes, and he has found me in the rain.
You mentioned the musical path. Okay, you went into UL and you found a way through your sister's drama, but how was it nurtured? Because that's the other thing. Like, you start relatively late, you got into it, you know, at least in your 20s. But how easy was it to follow it, to follow that passion at that stage, you know, quite late? And not late, but you know what I mean? Like, a lot of people will start at 10 or...
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And that actually is often quite off-putting for people, I think. I feel like it's almost a myth that's created around music, that everyone who succeeds in it or who's doing really well in it either comes from a very wealthy background or started very young, when there's a huge volume of us that came to music very late. I suppose I was always expressing myself musically or creatively some way or other, and you know what, being honest, it wasn't like I had this burning desire to be a musician. That was not the dream when I was a kid. I wanted to be an illustrator. I wanted to maybe be on stage acting or doing something like that. I never thought I'd be a musician. But I was always writing poetry and essays, and I was always kind of finding ways of those kind of outlets, you know? Both my parents are visual artists. So they understand the journey and they understand the desire to create. And also I didn't really give them much of a choice. So I was, as much as I was in school about doing my own thing, I was the same in my life at home as well. I would just kind of lock myself away. And, you know, as a teenager, I listened to Avril Lavigne and Evanescence and The White Stripes on repeat. I just had those CDs on my Discman all the time. And I was, I suppose, finding music as an outlet at that time, even though I didn't know it. And my parents saw that it made me happy, and there's not a whole lot more you can want for a kid. So I think they just let me off, to be honest.
Very good. You know, it's important because sometimes we do dampen those dreams, you know, as parents. And like, I'm a parent and I'm very conscious of that. And but yeah, it's interesting. And what happened to the illustrator dream? You still doing art, visual art or some sort?
You know, I don't do it as much as I should. I find it really therapeutic, but now art is just for me. I don't want to make it a job or anything. Occasionally I'll do like a little acrylics painting or a sketch, and I'll put it up on Twitter, and you know, people will like to see someone who's maybe working in one field doing something different, and it's yeah, interesting for them. But I don't think I'd ever want to make art a job. I really love it as an outlet, that has no pressure for me whatsoever. I tried to go to art college and failed miserably. Went into the interview with my portfolio, and my portfolio was terrible. It was so bad. I didn't know how to make a portfolio. I had no guidance. And I suppose I was at a stage as well in school where everyone seemed to be getting extra tutorials and grinds and stuff. And because I grew up with two parents who are artists, it seemed absurd to me to get grinds in art. And I knew I was a good artist, so again, it seemed absurd to get grinds. But it turns out that really those grinds were kind of training people into how the system works, which I didn't know about. So that dream went down the toilet pretty quick. But it doesn't bother me. I don't harbour any resentment about it. You know, it's something I love doing still. So
brilliant. Vieni, vieni, oh mio diletto, Vivaldi.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's tied in with the vocal nodule story again. It's the first song that my vocal coach, when I was coming out of them, taught me to sing. And whenever I hear it now, it just makes me really happy to hear it. It's a very, and I often forget that was the first piece of music that I learned to sing clearly without rasping or throat clearing or catching my breath. It's a really beautiful piece of music. That aside, my vocal coach at the time, who's a very well-known vocal coach around Limerick, Maura Keary Scanlon, she not only did she kind of bring home to me the importance of technique and being able to perform a piece, but also how important technique is in being able to emote while you're singing. So I had embodied all these terrible habits of like bringing my shoulder, because I'd seen it in movies and in music videos, you know, I'd seen people using their bodies to express what they were singing. But she taught me how to use my breath and how to use phrasing and all that kind of thing to convey an emotion through music. And that was my first encounter with that idea. So yeah, it's a complicated, a difficult classical music piece to sing. She really pushed my boundaries that time, which was great.
Thank you. just with the vocal nodule, I don't know anything about a vocal. I don't know what a vocal nodule is. But how long was it since you were diagnosed with it? Since you had to get an operation, or
thankfully, I was young enough, so it was actually very uncommon for someone my age to develop them. They're just a growth on your vocal cords from misuse and overuse. So the same way a muscle can get inflamed and develop lumps and bumps and become difficult to use. Your vocal folds, when they rub off each other in the wrong way, they can develop growths. And often you'll need an operation to have that removed. But I was young enough and it was caught early enough that I was able to get trained out of it. And now, you know, I'm always wary that they could come back. So I'm very cautious of how I use my voice. I don't, you know, I've never smoked. I don't speak in loud environments. Come across as a real diva probably a lot of the time, but I don't care. So yeah, it took, I was diagnosed with them when I was about 12, and I was walking around like a Disney princess singing all the time, 24/7. And my friends in school were taken aside by my mom and told, if you hear her singing, you have to tell her to stop. I wasn't allowed to sing at all. I had to mime in the choir and everything for 2 or 3 years until they were fully dealt with, which was really challenging for someone who, you know, music was a very big part of how I expressed myself. So it was kind of like being told, you're not allowed to be that person anymore. So yeah, it was difficult.
Wow. So then let's move forward to your first gig, because that's been told not to do what you love doing. And as Liam O'Malley said on this podcast, he said, you know, people are compelled to make music. It's like honey, the people's honey. Mm-hmm. That was a fabulous way of putting it. And if you can't do that, it must be really frustrating. But then fast forward a few years and you get your first gig, your proper first gig. Do you remember it? That very first gig?
And what was it? My very first gig was... What was my first gig? The first one I remember, I was dropping in on this weekly open mic in a pub called the Wicked Chicken in Limerick. It's closed now, which is a pity because it was a great place. It's a real dingy, dark bar. The place is like, the walls were kind of red and they felt like they were sort of pulsating in on you. There were this like uneven, weird sort of, you felt like you were literally inside a beating heart. It was so small and warm and intimate. And so I would drop in on this open mic every week, and the guy that hosted it was a poet, and he asked if I wanted to be the featured artist some week. So I said yeah, and I got up and I was so nervous, and I had a book in front of me of like lyrics and chords. And I didn't talk between, like, now a big part of what I do at gigs is I talk, you know, I tell stories and I connect with people, and there's a little bit of antagonism between me and the audience as well, and it's all part of the fun. Whereas this was my first time ever really having the attention of a room, and I just mumbled my way through a 30 minute 40 minute set of songs, and then kind of apologized for doing it and sat down again. And I remember Padder, the poet that hosted this night, came over to me afterwards and he was like, you know, you're allowed to talk during songs. Like, if you see someone coming in that you know, you can say hello to them, you can give out to them for being late, you can tell the people at the back of the room to stop talking, you know, like, be yourself on the microphone. You're witty and you have stuff to say, so say it. And that was like, I don't want to give him too much credit because, you know, he'll get a big head, but that was the first time someone had given me that guidance, and it was so important to me. And you know, I try since then, whenever I see someone who's on their first gig and clearly not comfortable behind the mic, you know, I do my best to go up and kind of give them a bit of guidance afterwards and let them know that it's okay to be themselves on the microphone and have a bit of fun. So yeah, that was my first, and there was like a load of Spanish and Italian students in the room as well down the back, and they were just there for their night out. They were studying English in Limerick, which is straight, like Ireland is a funny place to be studying English. But they were chatting away throughout the gig, and you know, now I know to tell everyone to shut the fuck up. But then I was just like, oh, you know, I'm so sorry for interrupting your conversation. So that was, yeah, that was my first experience of a real gig.
Nice one. You have this fantastic tune, My Funny Valentine, and Chet Baker, or anyone else's. I love the Chet Baker version, so that's probably the one I'm going to be playing. But tell me about it.
I went to this beautiful masterclass for a week in Mary Eye, which is it's a college in Limerick. And I learned to sing that song properly. I had just kind of stumbled upon it, I suppose, and liked it. So I decided that was the one I wanted to learn to sing. And I wound up, so at the end of that masterclass, we all recorded our song onto a CD. And it was just something to take away as a souvenir of the time, which was really gorgeous. And my granddad had a copy of that CD at home in Cork. And he would play it constantly, like a nauseating amount on repeat all the time around the house. And everyone was sick of it. But when he died on near enough to Valentine's Day, and I sang the song at his funeral, and it's become sort of that song is kind of synonymous with, I suppose, the support and love I got from my family when I was still just finding my voice and figuring out my career. And it sort of, I guess that love and support sort of propelled me to where I am now. So that song has a big place in my heart ever since.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable.
I came across you, as I was saying before we switched on the microphone, that I came across you while I'm doing this music program for Near FM. And after, I mean, I didn't know your existence until about a few months ago, but I'm glad I found you, because your first album is really amazing. It really is amazing, the Quiet Giant, and a couple other things you've done since that just lovely music, and genuinely I think it's amazing. But tell me about getting to the debut album, because a lot of artists I spoke to, and a lot of people always say, you know, it's your history up to that moment, it's you put everything into your first album and so on and so forth. Was it the same thing for you, or you know, getting to that, to print that very first one, which is 2017, if I'm right? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. No, that album was kind of an accident.
Great accident.
I got booked for this German tour in 2017. I was a last-minute recruit for this tour called the Irish Folk Festival. Niamh Dunn from Bioga kind of got me that gig. And so I said yes to the tour. But when I went to sign the contract, I went to Dublin to meet the manager of the tour, and I went to sign the contract, and he said, you'll have the CD ready for the tour in October. We were going to be leaving, and this was May, I would say, of 2017. And I was like, yeah, you know, I have my EP. You know, I had a 6-track EP that I had released. I was like, yeah, I have that. And he's like, no, you'll need an album. Everyone else has an album. You can't sell an EP. And I was like, of course, I knew that, and that's fine. So I will have an album for October, no problem. He's like, no, you'll need it for September. And I was like, that's even better, yeah, no problem. So I had to throw myself into, I was finishing my master's at the time as well, but I had to throw myself into finding a band, developing artwork, finding the right producers, and figuring out how making an album was going to work. So over the next 6 months, I had the songs written. They're all songs I had been putting together here and there, and I had gigged some of them at my EP launch, and that was you know, that took a lot of the work out of it, but it was still a very intense 6 months where I was writing my thesis and trying to put an album together that I never intended on putting together. So, it was a happy mistake, but definitely, it definitely wasn't a thing that my life had been building up to this moment. It was purely accidental.
Wow. Because I've been listening to it, not just because of this interview, I just listen. I really like it. And there's one particular song that stands out for me, is The Unbearable Lightness of Being. I suppose it's from the Milan Kundera book, I'm assuming. But yeah. Now that you say that you had to put a band together, I mean, there's some amazing, I don't know all the musicians that played on, but there's some amazing sound on it. So when you arrived there with your songs that you've written, I'm assuming you've written on the guitar or a piano or whatever, all of a sudden you have these other artists to put together and tell them what you want. That must have been quite a tricky one. Or you just found the right people that went to know, I know exactly what you want.
There was a bit of both. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of learning how to communicate, because I'm not a traditionally trained musician or a classically trained musician. So, and the artists I was working with were, you know, all extraordinary musicians. The nice thing was, I suppose, finding people who could take what I was saying and deconstruct it and figure out what I actually meant. And that's a real skill in musicians like the guys I had for that album. And we developed a really gorgeous relationship through learning that kind of communication. It was tricky. It definitely was. And I learned a lot about my own musical weaknesses during that time, which helped so much in producing the second album, which I approached in a totally different way. And I forfeited a lot of control in making the second album because I wanted it to be the best it could be. And the first album was the best it could be because I had the right people on it. I suppose it's every project you come to with the learning from the previous thing. And there was a lot of learning that happened during that. So, yeah.
Fantastic. That's great. And speaking of great artists, you picked Declan O'Rourke, Sarah. He's just, he's amazing.
He really is. He's one of my favorite songwriters and one of my favorite vocalists. And I love kind of observing his evolution and his growth as a musician as well, which is really evident in every album he releases. I don't think, like, maybe since Kai Abraham and Big Bad Beautiful World are kind of similar, but you're still hearing how he's changing as a person throughout those albums. Sarah is one that my mom introduced me to when I was a teenager, and she had introduced me to all of his work, and I'd seen a couple of his shows, but I hadn't decided at that stage that I was going to be a musician. But those albums were, I suppose, one of my first experiences of really connecting with music and feeling seen by lyrics and feeling understood by them and allowing them into my life in a way that I hadn't before. So Sarah, really, it struck me as a beautiful song. And I sang it as my audition piece for my degree in music in Limerick. Just a cappella, I sang it as kind of a Shannos traditional song. And I got into that degree, and, you know, the degree wasn't everything I maybe expected or wanted, but it taught me a lot about myself and about music. And then, I suppose through my degree, I met my boyfriend, and we went to see Declan at the University Concert Hall in Limerick, and he played Sarah with the orchestra, but he explained before playing it that the song is actually about his dog that died. And I'm a huge animal lover, so aside from the song being with me since I was a kid and being the piece that got me into my undergraduate degree, it then had this added importance of my boyfriend and I sharing this experience of seeing him at the concert hall with his orchestra and hearing that the song was about something I love so much as well. So it's a gorgeous song. For listeners who haven't heard it before, it's gonna blow them away.
Last night in a dream, Sarah came to me. across the flower beds of destiny. I called her name like it was yesterday, and we ran home through the fields in the rain.
Stay with the music for a second. Just, you've been doing this great thing over, and I don't know if it's just over the lockdown, you've been doing this Facebook Friday evening meetup where you bring in other artists and talk about different things. And they're great. I haven't watched every single one of them. I wish I had the time for it, but I watched a few, and it's just really nice format where you're just sharing your stories in you. And you pick, am I correct, you're picking a topic on a week that you like, you know, whether it's music from the movies or books or whatever, maybe. What has that done to you? Is that just happened through the lockdown, or is something you've always done?
It's just been through the lockdown. The nice thing with the current situation is I'm finding myself with a bit more time on my hands sometimes, not always, but sometimes. And I'm finding that I'm playing music for fun more than I ever allowed myself to before. So, and the sing song every week is a nice excuse and an opportunity to, I suppose, sift through, I mean, the endless catalogue of music out there. I've just found myself kind of really investigating songs in a way that I had never allowed myself to before, and enjoying them. So the sing songs have only been happening during the lockdown, and it was, I suppose, I'm just really conscious that a lot of charities aren't getting support like they were pre-lockdown. They can't run their usual fundraisers and usual drives. So I wanted to be able to do something about that and help them somehow. So every week we have a different cause that we help. And then the themes are just, they're just a parameter. They're just a bit of fun. But as I say, it's a great way to discover music I haven't really listened to properly, and have a chance to play those songs. People won't have heard me doing a lot of covers before. I just wouldn't have done them. And this is just something a bit different, a bit of crack. And I'm building a lovely community around it, which is what music should be about, you know, connecting with people and connecting people.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of that, and we were just saying at the very beginning of this, I mean, I think art is so important. And unfortunately, in a capitalist world we live in, sometimes it's seen as something that needs to happen. Yeah, sure, you're an artist, you just get on with it, you know, go and play your music, whatever. And I just was in the... somebody, Bresi or Steve Wall, I can't remember, somebody shared this thing that New Zealand the other day gave $169 million to the arts to support artists that have been out of work for the last 3 months. And I think on the same day, the Irish government gave $1 million, which I thought, you know, was a bit... I know they have other things to think about it, but how hard it is. I mean, now forget about the lockdown for a moment because nobody knows, but how hard it is to make a living as an artist. And something you're really passionate about. And I don't need to know your finances, obviously, but I just because I'm curious. Because it's really important that the likes of you continue to make music that is nice music to have, to listen to. But it's also the reality of, I don't know, mortgage rents and whatever else you have, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I kind of resigned myself to the idea that I'm never going to make a huge amount of money. If I'm relying on songwriting as my, or as a performer as my only income. So I get creative, you know, and I figure out other ways of doing things. And also I find it quite liberating that I sort of don't accept the label of songwriter, as my job, because I write songs. It's something I do sometimes, but I also do lots of other stuff as well. I'm an entertainer, and in that way, I suppose it leaves me open to other opportunities. So, I don't know. It is very, very difficult as an artist to live in Ireland and to make a living. But I've always sort of thought laterally and figured out ways of surviving. And I'm clever, I suppose, in the way I do things. So I do okay. I'm very privileged and very lucky to be in a position that I can continue to be a songwriter and live. I don't have kids. I'm not married. I don't have a mortgage, you know, so I don't have any of that pressure. Someday maybe, but not right now. So for now, I'm grand.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Good to know. You have this song, and this is the only one that you know, Birdhouse in Your Soul, There Might Be Giants.
Yeah.
Don't know anything about it. Tell me.
It's a really weird song. It's really weird. But I picked it because it is one of my, it's my best friend's, like one of her favorite songs. We met during our time at UL in Limerick. We met through the Drama Society, and she's someone who I've held on to since. I'm not someone who has a massive group of friends. I have a few people that I really connect with and have held on to, and she's one of them. And she's been there through a lot of stuff. And that song for me is like all of those nights out when, you know, neither of us necessarily wanted to just do the standard college experience of going out and getting drunk. So we'd like put on our favorite songs on a playlist. We lived in this house in Limerick that we paid very little rent for, but the house was huge and had a conservatory, and it was freezing all the time. We called it the cold house, and we would every month have this like culture night where we'd celebrate a different culture, and we'd dress up in clothes that we felt matched that culture. We'd watch their movies and drink their drinks, all that kind of thing. So everything was kind of an occasion. And if we were going out on just a normal night out, we'd put on that song, and we'd pick a theme to dress up in costume as, like maybe rainbow or mermaid or unconventional princess or something like that. And we'd just dress up a little bit crazy, and we'd go out to our favorite place in Limerick, Costello's Bar, which is like an alternative nightclub. And that song will always be the kind of theme tune to those misadventures.
Who watches over you? Make a little birdhouse in your soul, not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul.
So one of the reasons I want to talk to you, as well as the music, you're doing a lot of stuff for, you just mentioned the Friday night, you always pick a charity. You're very, I mean, you, even before talking to you and listening to some of the things you did, you come across as very compassionate, very, you know, you're very interested in other people. It's not just you. You're not just using your platform to boost your ego. It never comes across that way. It's always, you know, the fact you share with other artists alone is a fantastic thing, you know. But you also got I was reading that you got an award last year from the mayor of Limerick about mental health advocacy. Which is fantastic. Congratulations. I didn't know that.
Thanks.
But where did that come from? Because I know you, like, is your latest single, Marianne, you the proceeds of that are going to Safe Ireland, am I correct?
Yeah.
So it's just fantastic stuff. And especially you have to just discuss the fact that it's not a millionaire's lifestyle that you live or anything. So that's even more interesting to me than whoever else. So tell me a bit about that old mental health advocacy and Safe Ireland and why are you doing what you're doing?
Well, I suppose with the mental health advocacy, I'm someone who has struggled with my own mental health in the past, and I continue to. It's a really common thing among creative people that, and it's actually been shown, and I've had some great conversations about this, that when we're forced to work in a standard 9-to-5 office job, it's detrimental to the mental health of someone who needs a creative outlet. And an awful lot of us, because it is very difficult to make a living here in Ireland, an awful lot of us do need to work those jobs and need to be doing all of that stuff. And so you're seeing a real spike in mental health crises among the creative community. I suppose a lot of my altruism, for want of a better word, my outreach stuff comes from a place of hoping that someday, if I need those resources and those facilities and that help, it'll be there, and that I'll have done what I can to ensure that it is. I'm just very conscious that absolutely anyone that I know and love could need that support at any point. And there's, I wish the government supported these things more. I wish we didn't need to raise funds. I wish artists didn't need to forfeit income to support these things happening. But the reality is what it is, and I'd rather say I did what I could to help when the opportunity was there than to look back and say, oh yeah, I achieved everything I wanted to and now I'm where I am and I'm great. That's not what I want to do. So yeah, with mental health advocacy, for me, it's just being open and honest. That's all I've done. And any fundraising I've done has been because I've been in a position to be able to. And as I say, I'd like to use my platform where I can to do what I can. That's kind of it, really. With Mariana, right now, people who are in domestic abuse situations are incredibly vulnerable. Thankfully, I have no personal experience of it, but you just never know who you know and love might be in that situation. And I'd like for them to know that people care about them and they're not alone. So anything we can do to ensure that is great.
Absolutely. And it is a fantastic song as well. I listened to another interview you did about the genesis of the song as well, about some of your friends. So it's a beautiful, beautiful song and fantastic. But you're not just, you say, I'm just being open and honest. That's all I'm doing. And that's quite a big thing to do, you know, to be open and honest in this world of social media and a lot of fake stuff. So I think there's a lot more credit you could give yourself to, you know, to being open and honest is fantastic. And I'm sure you get reaction from the people you're aiming at, like the younger people that are maybe finding themselves in an awkward position in the moment. Would you get personal messages, people coming back to you say, look, that was fantastic, or?
What's happened more so is I've gotten contacted by a couple of counsellors who tell me that people have told them that my work has helped them. Which is great. I hear from, mostly who I hear from is older people who my music has helped, and that's, you know, it's always really beautiful. I find it very strange when someone tells me that my music has connected and has made a difference to them, because the songs I've written have never really been kind of like premeditated. You know, I don't put stuff out with a view to giving an impression of who I am or giving anyone it's really, everything I've written has just come from a place of, this is something I really feel like I want to express. And when I put it out with a press release saying it's about this, that and the other, it's just that's where I was when I wrote it, and that's how I felt, and maybe someone else feels that way too. And if so, great. But I never actually expect someone to connect so much with something that it helps them. It's beautiful that happens, but it's never expected.
Fabulous. And tell me about somebody that I'm, Cranberries. Why did you pick the Cranberries? Why did you pick why?
I grew up in the same city that Dolores grew up in, and I went to the same school that she went to. And as a woman in music, she's a shadow over everything. As a woman in music in Limerick, when I started gigging, when I first went up on stage after that open mic situation, I got people coming up saying, oh, you're very like Dolores. I'm not, and I wasn't. But I was a young girl in Limerick with short hair who was singing with a relatively normal local accent. So the connection was always being made. And now I see that for the privilege it is. It's, you know, it's a huge honor to be connected with her and to her in any way. When she died, I put together this big event in Limerick to recognize her. And I got together a bunch of artists from all over the country to sing her music. So there was like something like 35 or 40 musicians on stage in Limerick singing the music of the Cranberries, and that was gorgeous. But the weekend that she died, I was asked to go into 95FM, which is Limerick's local radio station, and sing a couple of songs by the Cranberries. And so I went through their kind of catalogue of music, and I discovered that song which she had written about her dad who had died. And it was her kind of asking if he's okay. And when she died, I had this very, like, I don't know how much I believe in anything, but I felt a very strong connection, and I was really shaken by her death, and I felt like a part of me was really struck by it. So I wanted to find a song that sort of communicated that, and that I really associated with those feelings. And that song by her, by the Cranberries, for me was that moment of someone dying and wanting to know that they're okay, and wanting some sign that everything would be okay down the line. So yeah, I mean, it's not one that I've played a huge amount of gigs. I do a lot of their other songs at gigs, but that one is, I learned it for that morning on 95FM, and it's the one I'll associate most with that moment of finding out she died and being brought into this world of the Cranberries and of Dolores that I had never been part of before, in any real active way. You know, suddenly I was the person being asked to do all the tributes and the person being asked to celebrate her life. And again, that's a huge honor, but it was new, and that song for me is the most connected to that time for me.
Somewhere in between here and heaven, somewhere in between where and why, somewhere in another dimension, I can hear you asking me why. Why? Why?
Now, I won't keep you much longer. I just have one last question. I heard you saying that. Then I found that in the last few weeks of this lockdown, I heard you saying something about your relationship with social media has kind of brought you closer to some people in a way, in a strange way. What's your overall relationship with social media? What's the good bit of it, or what's the bad part of it? Because obviously it's a vehicle for marketing and everything else that we all have to use. But beyond that, where is the good, where is the bad for you?
The good is that connection, you know, it's connecting with people I wouldn't otherwise necessarily have ever in a million years gotten to know. It's creating a community around your work that, you know, I mean, during lockdown, live streams mean that people who don't get to leave the house can connect with you and can hear live music and can be part of something. So I suppose the best part of social media for me is that sense of community. I'm someone who, I don't do well in groups. I don't really enjoy very noisy situations. I quite like my own space and my own time to do things. And social media for me is a great way to continue to connect with people, even when I don't want to be at the festival or don't want to be at the concert. So that's the good. And I think going forward, even when lockdown restrictions lift, I would hope to see artists continuing to reach out to their fans like this, because there's people who live their lives like this all the time, people who have chronic illnesses and people who are in a wheelchair or are bedbound. And this is making art and community accessible to those people.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And it is, it feels very personable, and, you know, be able to be in your sitting room or your kitchen, wherever you decide to play from. It's a lovely way. I watched a few things online just for that very reason, and it's nice. Just before I let you go, I always ask everybody for what I call the words of wisdom. Give me a quote or something that gets you up in the morning, something that, anything at all. Could be a song, could be a title of a book, anything at all.
oh God, this is so hard.
Could be Dr. Seuss. Could be Dr. Seuss.
You know what I think a really important thing, and I've heard Dhiren Garahi saying it a lot, is no one gives a shit about you. It's that very simple idea that don't not do things out of some idea that someone out there cares. Like, do the things you want to do, be the person you want to be, because at the end of the day, no one actually really cares. You can just don't care about them, and they won't care about you, and it's all fine. And that was a really good lesson to learn. Only in the past couple of years, I've started dressing the way I want to dress and doing my hair the way I want to do my hair and only wearing makeup for me and saying and doing the things I want to say and do because I want to say and do them, not out of any weird desire to make anyone else happy or impressed by me. And yeah, it's a bit of a long-winded message, but there you go.
Sounds great to me. And your last song is The Temptation of Adam by Josh Ritter.
It was in 2015, I was traveling in America and I had come out of a bad breakup and I was listening to that song and I wanted to write a response to it. It's a song that I love. I think it's a beautiful song and I think Josh Ritter is an incredible songwriter, but the message in the song and the way I was interpreting it at the time made me really angry. So I wanted to write a response to it, and that response was The Seduction of Eve, that song is the first song that ever got played on national radio by Carl Corcoran on Lyric FM, and I suppose sort of propelled me to a level of recognition on a national level that I might not have otherwise achieved. So I'm very grateful to Josh Ritter for writing The Temptation of Adam. And I'm very grateful for that bad breakup, and I'm grateful that I managed to write that song as a result of both. So
fantastic. Well, Emma Langford, thanks a million for your time. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Was a cold war, we could keep each other warm. I said on the first occasion that I met Marie, we were crawling through the hedge that was the missile silo door, and I don't think that she really thought that much of me. I never had to learn to love her like I learned to love the bomb. She just came along and started to ignore me. But as we waited for the big one, I started singing her my songs, and I think she started feeling something for me. We passed the time with crosswords that she thought to bring inside. What five letters spell apocalypse, she asked me. I won her over singing W-W-I-I-I. We smiled and we both knew that she'd misjudged me. Oh, Marie, it was so easy fall in love with you. It felt almost like a home of sorts or something. And you would keep the warhead missile silo good as new, and I watched you with my thumb above the button. And then one night you found me in my army issue card, and you told me of your flash of inspiration. You said fusion was the broken heart that's lonely's only thought.